Panama says maybe not to China. The Trump administration is calling that a victory. It's a choice for Latin America, move forward with the U.S. or with China.
These are both critically important partners.
I'm Marco Werman. More today on the competition between Washington and Beijing for influence in Latin America. And how those private messages on your smartphone might not be so secure.
To me, it remains astonishing that more muscular measures are not taken against the companies who make a business of hacking American companies and, in many cases, facilitating the hacking of Americans.
Plus, in Norway, authorities are doing what they can to protect wild Atlantic salmon from some serious threats.
On the top of the list, climate change and farmed fish has been the major risk factors.
That's all ahead today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Carolyn Beeler is out today. Thank you for spending part of your Tuesday here. Panama says it will not renew its participation in China's Belt and Road Initiative. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who just visited Panama this week, is applauding that announcement. Panamanian officials are reportedly also reconsidering their contract with a Hong Kong-based company that operates ports near the Panama Canal. All this would be a major concession to President Trump, who has complained about China's influence over the strategic waterway. China's Belt and Road Initiative is the signature foreign policy project of Chinese leader Xi Jinping. We asked Margaret Myers to talk through the significance of Panama's decision. She's a senior advisor at the United States Institute of Peace.
Well, this would be a major development in the Panama-China relationship, but also in terms of China's broader engagement with the Latin American region. The region has been a sort of newcomer to the Belt and Road Initiative with the first ever Belt and Road Agreement, which is essentially a memorandum of understanding signed by Panama in 2017, followed by several other agreements across the region with most all of the countries in Latin America at this point in time. So this would be the first effort by any country in the region to adapt, change, or certainly cancel that agreement, and is something that would be hugely symbolic in terms of the bilateral dynamic between Panama and China, and a real blow to China and to the Belt and Road Initiative, broadly speaking.
Well, as you know, Margaret, the Belt and Road Initiative has brought hundreds of billions of dollars of infrastructure investment around the globe, including in Central and South America. What is China trying to accomplish in the region? Is there an overall strategy beyond economic?
In addition to the wide-ranging economic and industrial policy-related goals and objectives, there are also other objectives that China is pursuing. And we see that often in sort of the types of infrastructure that are being developed, pursued, invested in, right?
Such as?
Well, the Panama Canal could be considered part of that equation, right? But ports and other things are critically important in terms of China's overall views on and plans for transport security, right? So a lot of what China is building is connecting to critical materials, critical resources, right, that will be needed, and the supply of which is absolutely fundamental to China. And so building rail from, for example, a major soy-producing region in Brazil to the coast, right, is a critical thing to do. Building ports on the Pacific coast of South America, for example, is another top priority, such as Chancay, which we've heard a lot about, right, in Peru, which will enable the exportation of all kinds of raw materials, right, to China that avoid other transport routes that could be problematic. The Gulf of Aden, for example, transporting through the Gulf of Aden or the South China Sea or other contested waters or, you know, a potential choke point such as the Taiwan Strait. So looking to diversify sea lines of communication.
So Latin American countries are, to an extent, caught in the middle of this rivalry between Washington and Beijing. Do they have to choose sides, or can they play both at once, or even play the two sides against each other?
I mean, certainly the objective is to engage with both, right? These are both critically important partners. For some countries, China is the top trade partner. For many now in the region, I would say most in South America, right? But the U.S. is a close second or remains the top trade partner for certain countries in the region. Both are also critically important investors, especially if we're talking about investment stock, right? So it's really you know, fundamental for these countries to be able to engage and to engage effectively, especially on economic terms with both actors. Both also come to the table with different propositions, right? China's more inclined to do big infrastructure. The U.S. is more inclined to help in other areas such as security cooperation, which is quite fundamental at this juncture. So whether they'll be able to do this, right, effectively, I think is top of mind for any policy planner. Certainly Panama is of top focus right now. Colombia, too, is in the spotlight in ways that it hasn't been in the past as concerns sort of its own China relationship and aspirations. Mexico, too, is facing a lot of pressure from the United States. And my sense is that these pressures, you know, will escalate, as will the realization that these countries are hugely dependent on China at this particular juncture.
That's Margaret Meyer, senior advisor at the United States Institute of Peace. When the White House hit pause on all U.S. foreign assistance, it made a few exceptions, including food aid for Rohingya refugees. Around 1 million Rohingya Muslims are living in camps in Bangladesh after fleeing their home country of Myanmar. But as the world's Patrick Wynn reports, Rohingya refugees are still facing threats to their survival.
Ro Abdumanov treasures memories from his old village in Myanmar before everything turned upside down.
I still remember everything.
He remembers endless rice paddies, the madrasa where he studied, and his mom's fish curry.
It was wonderful. I still miss it.
Then the Myanmar military rolled in 2017, claiming the Rohingya, a Muslim minority, were unworthy to live inside the country. Soldiers torched villages in a campaign the U.S. has called a genocide.
Burning, raping, killing. So there is no way to stay, and we came to Bangladesh.
For days, Abdumanov, his mom, his brother, and sister, they crept westward towards a river. On the other side was Bangladesh. They almost drowned crossing the waters, and they had no clue what would happen as they entered another country illegally. Fortunately, some locals showed kindness.
After we arrived, local people gave us some food and snack.
Soon, Bangladesh border guards showed up, and they were nice too. They drove Abdumanov's family to a refugee camp where they live today. Many Rohingya people had experiences like this in the past, but much has changed. Today, Bangladeshi authorities are under orders to keep Rohingya out.
Official policy is a closed border.
A closed border. Wendy McCants is with the humanitarian group Norway Refugee Council. She works near the Myanmar-Bangladesh border, assisting refugees.
Some people have been walking for weeks to even get to the border. Some of those do get stopped by the border guard and pushed back.
Bangladeshi leaders say the country has reached its limits on refugees. It's already densely populated and ravaged by storms. Many of its own citizens don't get enough food. At the same time, Wendy McCants confirms, even with tighter enforcement at the border, Rohingya refugees keep trying to come across in large numbers.
Yes, there's been a steady increase and continues to do so.
The Rohingya fleeing now, they're no longer escaping Myanmar's military. There's a new group in charge of their homeland.
We are coming to take our country back.
That's a video from the Arakan Army. They're an armed faction sworn to defend the Arakan, a Buddhist people native to the same land as the Rohingya. Myanmar is home to dozens of minority groups with one thing in common. They've all been persecuted by the military regime. Now that regime is under siege on all sides by many armed revolutionary groups. The Arakan Army is one of the most successful, recently liberating their area. That idea of liberty includes the Rohingya, so they say, but not everyone is buying it.
They were keep pretending as if they are the good guy for the Rohingya.
Ne San Wen is a Rohingya analyst based in Germany who tracks abuses against his people. He says the Arakan Army behaves a lot like Myanmar's central military, burning villages and killing Rohingya civilians.
They are finishing the unfinished business of the Myanmar military. You know, this is very obvious.
Arakan Army leaders deny this. They chalk up Rohingya deaths to collateral damage. But one thing is for sure, the Arakan Army is capable of brutality, as proven by a newly leaked video of their fighters capturing Myanmar troops and burying them alive. The Arakan Army admits the video is real and says its fighters will be punished. Naysan Wen says the video is chilling, even to Rohingya people. Yes, Myanmar soldiers tormented us too, he says, but they don't deserve torture.
Regardless of race and religion, victim are victim. How they can slaughter and kill the people like that, you know?
Even if Rohingya families fleeing violence manage to slip into Bangladesh, what awaits them there is pretty dire. The refugee camps are growing impossibly crowded, with gangs rising up to compete for scarce medicine and food. Abdulmanov says even with foreign aid coming in, it's not enough. People are underfed and cracking under the pressure.
There's a lot of horrible things happening. Many people are depressed and stressed.
Depressed and stressed. Last year, the U.S. supplied more than $200 million to refugees in these camps. The Rohingya are hoping America does not snip that lifeline in 2025. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
Apes and humans apparently understand each other more than we previously thought. A recent experiment found that bonobos, an ape species similar to chimpanzees, can understand when we humans lack knowledge and they can point us in the right direction. We reached out to Chris Kurpenya. He's an evolutionary cognitive scientist at Johns Hopkins University, and explained to us how he conducted the experiment.
So what happened was a bonobo was sitting across from a human partner, and food, a treat, was hidden under one of three cups. And what we varied was whether the partner could observe the food being hidden or not, and so whether the partner knew where the food was or wasn't. And when the table was slid to the partner to make a choice, in this case, they actually waited for 10 seconds. And during that time, the bonobo could choose to point to indicate the location of the food. And what we found was that they spontaneously pointed more often and more quickly for their partner if he hadn't seen where the food was hidden than if he had. So the bonobo in this case ultimately is acting in his own interest, right? He still wants the food, but nonetheless, he has to coordinate with this partner. They're working together in some capacity in order to get the treat for the bonobo.
So what were the conclusions then that you reached on this experiment in terms of assessing bonobo's ability to understand a human's lack of knowledge and then their ability to help them?
The kind of novel piece here is that they also seem to grasp when someone has a different view of the world than they do. So they know when someone lacks information and they can act accordingly. So that means that in some ways, they're able to hold in mind two views of the world. Like the bonobo knows where the food is. He's correctly tracking its location. He knows reality. But at the same time, he also knows that this other person's understanding of the world is different from his and is lacking that information. And so that was one key advance. And then the other one is that they can actually use communication in this very tailored way in order to enable forms of cooperation that and coordination that we thought maybe were unique to humans.
Was there a reason why bonobos in particular were chosen for this experiment?
Right. So bonobos are one of our two closest relatives. Bonobos and chimpanzees both share a common ancestor with us that goes back 6 to 9 million years ago. So those species are particularly valuable because they can tell us what's unique about our species, and as well, they can tell us which features of our psychology are shared and were probably present millions of years ago in that common ancestor.
Is there a larger conclusion, do you think, Chris, that your findings from this experiment might show us about the connections between apes and humans generally?
Well, I think on the one hand, they really show us that like humans, other apes lead rich social and mental lives, that there's a lot going on in their minds. So in many ways, they're much more similar to us than we realized. But we also have these kind of interactions that are challenging in some ways. Chimpanzees and bonobos are both endangered species, and they're, you know, are imperiled specifically because of our own species. And there's this conflict there because they provide this special link to understanding our place in the natural world, what makes us special, what we share with others. And at the same time, we risk losing that understanding of ourselves because of the conservation challenges that these species face.
Chris Kurpenya is an evolutionary cognitive scientist at Johns Hopkins University. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. WhatsApp, which millions of people use for voice calls and text messaging, boasts of its end-to-end encryption, giving privacy and peace of mind to users. But on Friday, Meta, the owner of both WhatsApp and Facebook, notified around 90 users to tell them that their phones had been hacked. Malware sold by a company called Paragon was apparently used to get into those devices. The victims of the hack are reported to include journalists and members of civil society. John Scott Railton is following all of this closely. He's a senior researcher at Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto.
So one of the good things about being a large platform is that you can sometimes track hacking against your users. And big platforms that are used by a lot of people, like WhatsApp, are common targets for sophisticated hacking groups, both because they want to know what people are talking about, but also because they can be used as a route to infect the phone that the app is installed on.
So what can you tell us about this Paragon software and how it actually works?
Your listeners may be familiar with names like Pegasus and other kinds of what we call mercenary spyware. Paragon fits into that same category. They're a company that sells, they say, exclusively to governments. And according to their marketing materials and what they've said before, they pride themselves on being hard to find and very light touch. The key thing to know about this kind of company is that they're selling what we call zero-click hacking. What that means is that 1 minute, your phone in your pocket is yours with all of your private data, your external brain, and the next minute, it is infected with this spyware, silently streaming data back to whoever is operating it. It's a pretty terrifying thing because there's no mistake you as a user can make, no link to click on, attachment to open, deception to fall for. You're simply private 1 minute and your device is penetrated the next.
How widespread are these kinds of spyware attacks?
Unfortunately, wherever we as researchers scratch, we tend to find. And what we're happy about is when companies like WhatsApp really dig and try to find this kind of targeting across their platform and notify users. But what's critically important is that the platforms investigate and then take action to blunt the attacks. That's what WhatsApp has done. Not only did they introduce some technical measures that dismantle this particular, we would say, vector of attack, but they also notified users, which we think is a critical piece of the puzzle because it means that there can start being accountability around this kind of abuse, this kind of targeting.
So does WhatsApp routinely monitor and alert users that they may have been spied on or hacked?
So the first case that some people may remember is back in 2019, NSO Group, which makes Pegasus, targeted about 1,400 WhatsApp users across WhatsApp in a sort of similar kind of attack, something that users wouldn't have necessarily had a link to click on or seen very much. WhatsApp not only went ahead and notified those users, but they actually sued NSO Group in US court. And as of today, they have prevailed in that case, which is pretty remarkable. And as somebody who's worked on this kind of issue for a long time, we think it's great when platforms really investigate and look for evidence of this kind of sophisticated hacking. They find the groups, they see who they're targeting, and then they notify and they put their shoulder behind the effort to hold these groups accountable. Otherwise, you and me as users, there's not much guidance I can give you. If this stuff is going to target you, there's very little that you as a user can do to protect yourself, which is why the protections have to come through consequences, through legal consequences, in some cases through sanctions and other mechanisms to really pump the brakes on the proliferation of this technology, which is extremely widespread to governments around the world.
You've mentioned the Israeli firm NSO Group and Pegasus.
Yeah.
It's Pegasus spyware a couple of times. Is Pegasus still being sold to customers?
Pegasus spyware is still a thing. Now, in the past couple of years, first the previous Trump administration and then the Biden administration realized that mercenary spyware was an issue for them. And it was an issue for U.S. national security because not only are these companies whose business model is hacking American platforms, that is their business model, but their stuff is also used against U.S. government personnel, American citizens, and American allies. And this shows just how serious this problem is. It's not something that's just faced by journalists and human rights defenders and other truth tellers. It's something that cuts right to the heart of every government's cybersecurity. And to me, it remains astonishing that more muscular measures are not taken against the companies who make a business of hacking American companies and, in many cases, facilitating the hacking of Americans.
Yes. Yeah, so if the companies say misuse of their products is not their fault, and if the countries that regulate them do not stop it, who can protect the privacy of our mobile phones?
And in fact, we have good evidence for a pathway that works. So the previous administration unveiled some sanctions. They did an executive order on commercial spyware. There were some visa bans. And that seems to have freaked out the mercenary spyware ecosystem. It led to a lot of changes. A bunch of companies became insolvent. Some others closed shop. And it was a big disruption. And so I think what we are hoping to see is both that the U.S. sort of continues based on what it knows about what to do, but also that other governments really lean in to try to combat this problem. Because if they don't, the future that we're in is every government hacking everybody profligately all the time. And that just does not contribute to anybody's idea of our collective security.
That's John Scott Railton. He's a senior researcher at Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto. Seyun Kuti is a lot like his dad, the legendary Nigerian musician Fela Kuti. Father and son, both known for spreading the sound of Afrobeat, singing songs about injustice and corruption. Fela died more than 25 years ago, but Seyun continues to carry those themes on his latest album, Heavier Yet Lays the Crownless Head. This track, T.O.P., stands for Things Over People, with Seyun calling out rulers and elites for exploiting workers for their own personal material gain. Seyun's also enlisted the son of another famous musician on one track, Damian Marley, son of the late Bob Marley. The Kutis from Nigeria and the Marleys from Jamaica are two powerful musical dynasties. This is Seyun and Damian's number, Day, meaning stay, a call to embrace both their African identities. Their fathers would approve. Love, 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 love. The album is Heavier Yet Lays the Crownless Head by Nigeria's Seyun Kuti. In our newsroom, we've got a lot of fans of music from all over the planet. Check out some of the tracks we've got on rotation and that you hear on the show. Find the world's playlist on Spotify. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast. An American guy decides to leave home and move to Japan. No one really knows why, because this was at a time, the 19th century, when that sort of thing would have been very difficult for people to fathom.
It would be like someone today deciding that they wanted to go to the moon.
That story is still ahead here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Syria's new interim president, Ahmed al-Shara, took his first international trip this week as the acting head of state. He visited Saudi Arabia, where he met with the kingdom's crown prince in Riyadh, and also went to the holy city of Mecca with his wife. That was their first public appearance together. Today, al-Shara arrived in Turkey's capital, Ankara, where he met with President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The world's Duri Buscarin is in Istanbul and describes how that meeting went.
So al-Shara arrived to a somewhat muted fanfare. I mean, usually Erdogan will roll out some mounted guards, a band, a big blue carpet for a head of state. None of that today. Just a lot of cameras and a handshake. I took it as a sign that Erdogan doesn't want to welcome him too warmly. The rebel group that he led, which took over most of Syria in December, it originated as an al-Qaeda affiliate and is still listed as a terror group. There's still a lot of ambiguity about what kind of a leader he'll be.
Yeah, and go a little further on that. What do you mean by ambiguity?
I mean, initially in Syria, there's been a lot of hope that al-Shara might be willing to set up a representative democratic government. In his first interview as president the other day, he said that he wanted Syria to have a parliament and an executive government. But based on comments from his ministers about the role of women in public life, for example, or even comments yesterday where he said it would take 4 to 5 years before he'd be willing to hold elections in Syria, there are signs that he could have an autocratic shift. And that's why these international visits are so interesting, because we're starting to get a sense of what he plans to do, who he plans to ask for help, and who his allies are shaping out to be.
Okay, so what did he and Erdogan discuss?
The big topic today was increased military cooperation between Turkey and Syria. In a joint press conference after the meeting, Turkish President Erdogan said that his country is ready to provide necessary support to the new Syrian government in the fight against terrorism. And he also said that Turkey would support Syria with humanitarian aid and help the country rebuild.
Direniş azimleriyle bölge.
In this clip from the press conference they held together, he's saying, our Syrian brothers who have inspired the region and the oppressed with their tenacity of resistance will raise the country back on its feet with God's permission. We have no doubt about it.
What does Turkey want in Syria?
Turkey is still conducting airstrikes and backing rebels in northeastern Syria in territory controlled by the U.S.-backed Kurdish coalition, the Syrian Democratic Forces. In the city of Kobani, for example, the situation is pretty bad. I mean, Turkish attacks on a hydroelectric dam there have taken out the electrical grid. They've taken out running water. People have put up aluminum sheeting and blankets over a central market area because there are so many surveillance drones. They're trying to hide themselves from kind of an aerial view. And Turkey is attacking Northeast Syria because it considers the SDF to be an extension of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or the PKK. This is a Kurdish militant group that has waged an insurgency in Turkey for about 40 years, I mean, since the 90s. And they still carry out attacks on Turkish soil as well, one as recently as October. So Turkey sees the SDF in Syria as a threat on its own border.
Now, as you said, Duri, the SDF was backed by the United States to defeat the Islamic State. How does all this now situate U.S. troops in the region?
Right. I mean, U.S. forces remain deployed in Syria to support the SDF, which is guarding prisons of people affiliated with ISIS. I mean, that was the original reason why the U.S. supported the SDF in Syria. What has changed is the U.S. presidency. With Trump in office, Erdogan is hoping he can ask Trump to pull these U.S. troops out, leaving the Kurdish militias exposed and without a negotiating position. And you may remember, I mean, when Trump did this in 2019, it felt like it came out of nowhere. It was during his first term. He did it right after a phone call with Erdogan, and it's very possible he'll do it again. The SDF has expressed willingness to join the new Syrian government if it is a federation, meaning that Kurds could retain certain freedoms and autonomy, and they're doing their own negotiations with al-Shara.
Yeah, a whole lot of ground shifting at once. So long term, what does Erdogan hope to gain in Syria?
Turkey sees a vacuum here. Iran was the main backer of the Assad regime, and Turkey sees a place that it can step in, both not just to help, but Erdogan is hoping for Turkey to be a big part of the rebuilding process. He has a lot of allies in the cement and construction companies in Turkey in particular, and they could stand to gain a lot in some of these contracts to rebuild Syria. The other reason that Erdogan has a stake in a peaceful Syria is because about 3 million Syrian refugees still live in Turkey, and Turkey has received money from the European Union to help support them financially. But a lot of Turkish voters have blamed the newcomers on Turkey's economic problems in recent years. Surveys show that many Syrian refugees do not plan to return. They cannot afford to return. A lot of them express concerns about the security situation in Syria. It's just too soon to know if it's possible to go back. But the Turkish government is hoping that they will.
The world's Duri Bascaran in Istanbul. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
A town in Spain is trying to live up to its name. It's called Libros, or Books in English, population 60. Libros is in a Spanish region called Teruel. It's so off the beaten track that for a while its tourism slogan was Teruel also exists. To attract visitors, the town of Libros wants to open its first ever library. The mayor is making a plea for book donations online. The world's Jerry Haddon went to see what happened next.
On a typical winter's day in the village of Libros, about the most exciting thing that happens is the ringing of the church bell which startles flocks of pigeons living in the belfry.
Muchas palomas, la verdad. Sí que hay muchas. Tristemente, más que personas.
We have lots of pigeons here, says Libros' mayor, 36-year-old Raúl Arana. Sadly, he says, more pigeons than people. I'm chatting with Arana on the ground floor of the town hall. Once upon a time, some 2,500 people lived in Libros. Most worked on farms or in the nearby sulfur mines, now closed. But like lots of villages in Teruel, most of the elderly have died off, Arana says. The young emigrated.
No quiero que llegue aquello. Es difícil porque aquí quieras que no hay vida.
I don't want things to come to that, he says. It's tough because there's still a tiny bit of life happening here in Libros. But if new folks don't come, he says, in the end, this town will die. To get them to come, Arana is counting on these. Books for his dream library. There are piles of them everywhere. 70,000 have arrived since Arana first put out the call online a year ago last June. The hashtag on the socials, Libros para Libros, or Books for Books, it went viral.
Nos ha llegado libros de todas partes del mundo. Nos han llegado desde Argentina, desde Francia.
They've arrived from all over the world, Arana says, from Argentina, France, Germany. 12 boxes alone came from Mexico, he says, and of course from Spain. A quick glance at the tilting towers of books reveals all kinds, novels, kids' books, history volumes, and encyclopedias. At one point, Arana says the postman was coming by so many times a day that they just gave him a key to the building. It got to the point where Arana could barely reach his office, so he and volunteers from town moved a bunch of the books to a warehouse, the rest to a third location. He offers to show me. We climb into his van along with the town handyman, 37-year-old Adrian Soriano. We pass a small bus pulling into the town square. Look, Soriano says, pointing, that school bus is bringing home the one child still living in town. After a minute, we pull over on a hill on the edge of town, and here, on a patch of dirt, is Arana's book depository. A big red shipping container. Arana and Soriano open it up. It's filled to the ceiling. Arana says he paid $3,000 for the container, money the tiny town can't really afford. And this is where the success and euphoria of the online book drive meets the reality of Libros, the village. Now we just need the library itself, Arana says. The regional government likes the idea, but they say it will cost some $4 million to build it. We don't have the money, he says, but I'm sure we'll find it. Arana says they'll apply for funds from the European Union if need be. His idea to combine the library with a hotel to pay the salary of a librarian. Someone, he says, needs to organize the collection. Arana says he's confident because there's proof already that literary tourism can work here. This is best-selling Spanish author Maribel Medina talking to Teruel TV about a project she runs called My Town Reads. It stages literary events in tiny villages, including Libros, inviting famous authors to visit, sign books, and spend the night. Libros has hosted 4 events with Medina's help. Arana says hundreds of people show up each time. You know, he says, it seems that because of our little literary boom, folks are starting to fix up the houses here. On weekends, he says, more people are returning. It may be too early to judge, but at the end of one of the town's steep dead-end lanes, there are signs of renewal. Past a bunch of crumbling homes, I meet 81-year-old Libros native Santiago Pérez coming out of his garage. I have 2 sons, he tells me, but neither wanted to stay on in Libros. They moved to nearby cities. But then he walks me down the hill a bit and points to a house with scaffolding around it. But one of my boys has set out to fix up that one, he says, smiling. He's making a really nice home for himself. That's just one person, but when you're on the verge of disappearing, says Mayor Arana, each resident makes a difference. The library hotel will generate jobs, he says. People need work, which is why they leave to begin with. If we can bring back just 7 or 8 families, he says, well, they'd count as villagers. If Libros itself were a book, you wouldn't call this a happy ending, not yet anyway. It reads more like the start of a promising next chapter. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Libros, Spain.
In Norway, authorities are putting major new restrictions on salmon fishing. That's because the country's wild salmon population has seen a serious population decline. Salmon farming is a major contributor to this, and Norway is the global leader in farm-raised salmon. Knut Vik Volset is a member of the Norwegian Scientific Advisory Committee for Atlantic Salmon. He spoke with me earlier today from the city of Bergen, and I asked him how serious this decline in the wild salmon population is.
We've had some of the worst marine survival of Atlantic salmon in our time series so far. So yeah, I would say it's quite serious.
And how does what's happening in Norway compare to elsewhere across the Atlantic?
It's quite similar to what we were seeing in other places around Atlantic. I mean, Norway has been one of the places where it has been the best marine survival of Atlantic salmon over the last few decades. And the decline we're seeing now is occurring elsewhere as well, according to what I've heard from my colleagues, at least.
Help us understand what some of the major factors are that are contributing to this decline in wild salmon populations.
There's different things going on in different countries and different regions. But in Norway, on the top of the list, climate change and farmed fish has been the major risk factors.
Yeah, so talk more about the impact of farmed salmon in Norway. How big is that industry to start with?
For comparison, the number now is that farmed salmon outnumber wild salmon by 1 to 1,000 approximately.
1 to 1,000. And the farmed fish would be the 1,000. Is that what you're saying? So overwhelmingly farmed.
That is correct. And of course, if we're looking at the average number of wild Atlantic salmon coming back to the coast of Norway, it's about 500,000. And you can multiply that with 1,000 approximately to get the number of farmed fish that's in farms along the coast.
So drill down a little more there. How does salmon farming have an impact on the population of wild salmon?
Yeah, there's three major factors that we assess impacts by farmed fish, and that is introgression of escaped farmed fish. So they escape and then they migrate into rivers and they can mix with wild fish, and then you get a genetic inbreeding of farmed fish, which makes the different populations along the coast more similar to each other because they're all impacted by the same type of farmed fish, making them more vulnerable to other factors. And then you have diseases. So we assess generally the other diseases from farmed fish, which are parasites and bacteria and viruses. But then on top of the list is the copepodic parasite, which is called salmon louse, that infests salmonids. And it's a natural parasite, but because there's so many more hosts to produce this parasite now, it's a problem for outmigrating salmon smolts as they migrate to sea.
Now, the government in Norway recently announced the most restrictive salmon fishing season the country has seen. What impact do you think that's going to have on the wild salmon population?
I mean, fishing is one factor that impacts the wild populations. But of course, just a couple of decades ago, there was a lot more rivers open for fishing. And now there's not. And the decline has been compensated to a certain degree by reducing amount of fisheries. But you can't do that forever. At some point, even just stopping fishing isn't enough.
Hmm.
Stopping fishing is an important tool in the toolbox to sort of alleviate the wild populations from impacts, but in some cases it's not enough. I mean, in the west coast of Norway, the rivers has been closed now for several decades in areas which has been most heavily impacted.
So what measures do you think are needed to just save wild salmon in the future?
I think there's multiple things. In areas which are heavily impacted by farms, you need to curtail that impact somehow. There's different ways of doing that, just sort of curtailing the production, of course. And there's a close containment system that's now being constructed, and there's different ways of doing that. But at the same time, there's multiple other anthropogenic factors that you can do something about, like impacts of river regulations has been a big impact of Norwegian salmon. There's been other things like constructions in rivers and road construction along rivers that's impacting habitat alterations and all those type of things. But we know how to do something about those things, so we should just be doing them. But at the same time, there's an X factor in all of this, especially in the Atlantic, which is climate change, but also invasive species such as the Pacific pink salmon is also invading Norwegian rivers and European rivers now. So we don't exactly know what the future brings, but I think the most important thing is to try to do as much as we can with those factors we know something about.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that despite the measures Norway has taken to protect wild salmon, the fish are still under pressure there. I mean, it suggests how hard it is to do this protection.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It would be easier if we knew and could predict exactly what the marine survival would be. But that is very unpredictable. And the changes in marine survival doesn't happen gradually. It happened really quickly over a few years. Of course, sometimes marine survival also goes up, but generally over the last decades, it's been going down, and in some cases really rapidly.
Knut Vik Fulset is a member of the Norwegian Scientific Advisory Committee for Atlantic Salmon. People in parts of the world that deal with cold winters learn to embrace a pro-snow mindset. In northern Japan, just how pro is being tested this week. Record-breaking snow blanketed the northern main island, with 4 feet of snow falling in Hokkaido on Tuesday. The Japan Meteorological Agency is predicting more snow through tomorrow. Schools, roads, airports, postal service, all disrupted or canceled. But no injuries or damage reported so far. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Today, Japan is one of America's most important allies. But let's rewind to the mid-19th century. For more than 200 years, Japan was largely isolated from the outside world. No one could leave, and foreigners were forbidden entry. So imagine this. In 1848, a young man from the Pacific Northwest decides he's going to risk his life by breaking into this closed-off land on the other side of the world. From Japan, reporter Rebecca Rossman picks up his story.
His name is Ronald McDonald, or maybe it's Ranald McDonald, depending on who you ask. Either way, no, he doesn't bear any relation to that popular fast food franchise. I already asked. This McDonald was a bank clerk, born just over 200 years ago in present-day Oregon. When he was in his mid-20s, he somehow ended up here. This is a tiny, windy, volcanic island called Rishiri. It's located about 13 miles off the coast of Hokkaido, Japan's northern island. To get here, I had to take one of those tiny propeller planes from Sapporo, Hokkaido's largest city. It runs only once a day. My point is, getting here wasn't easy. But when this guy McDonald decided he wanted to sail to Rishiri from the U.S. back in 1848...
It would be like someone today deciding that they wanted to go to the moon.
That's author Frederick Schott. He's written a 448-page biography of McDonald.
There was no way for an ordinary individual to get to Japan.
It was the tail end of a 200-year period known as Sokoku, which literally translates to chained country. The government wanted to keep out any foreign influence, especially anything involving Christianity. Almost all foreigners were banned from entering Japan. Those who tried risked their lives. And yet this guy, McDonald...
He just sails right in. The most amazing thing. It's not clear exactly what his goal was, and that's one of the fascinating things about his story. There are allusions to a secret plan that he might have had, but no one knows exactly what he wanted to do.
Born in 1824 to a Scottish fur trader and a Chinook mother, McDonald grew up in a culturally rich environment, traveling across the U.S. and Canada. From a young age, he was also fascinated by Japan. Some say he was captivated by stories of shipwrecked sailors who described it as forbidden and unreachable. There's also speculation he felt he had a physical resemblance to the Japanese people, and that played a role in his motivation to get to Japan. So when he's in his mid-20s, he quits his day job as a bank clerk, becomes a sailor, and moves to Hawaii, where he meets these whalers who are planning a trip to the Far East.
His way of getting to Japan, or getting close to Japan, was to get there on a whaling ship, and that's really the only way you could do it.
McDonald strikes a deal with the whalers. In exchange for his wages, he asks to be let off in the Sea of Japan and given his own boat with provisions. The captain agrees. They set sail in late June. They make it to the Sea of Japan a month later, and as promised, McDonald is given a dinghy.
And he launched himself off the shores of Japan and wound up on Rishiri Island.
When locals found him here, he pretended his boat had capsized. Still, he was quickly arrested and interrogated, then detained in Nagasaki. But now here's the twist in the story. McDonald ends up being no ordinary prisoner. Eiji Nishiya is a Japanese historian from Rishiri Island. He says when McDonald was transferred to Nagasaki, people saw an opportunity in him. See, at the time, he says, there weren't really any English speakers in Japan. There were some Dutch translators. The Dutch had special rights to trade during the Sokoku period. But English, that was something else. And this was 1848, just a few years before Japan would start to open up again. Interpreters knew that English would be useful for them, too. So they taught McDonald some Japanese. In turn, he became what many refer to as Japan's first English teacher. He taught English to some of the country's top interpreters, all while he was still detained by the Japanese government.
Enough English that it helped in the negotiations. In the initial negotiations with the United States Navy, with Commodore Perry, who arrived with this fleet of, you know, naval ships and forced Japan to open.
Commodore Matthew C. Perry is the U.S. Navy officer who sailed to Japan in 1853, effectively forcing an end to Japan's 220 years of isolationism through a series of negotiations. He's the man who gets all the credit anyway. But you could say McDonald helped lay the groundwork for him. But McDonald never really got to see the fruits of his labor. He was released from captivity in the spring of 1849 and almost immediately made his way back to the U.S. When he arrived back home, McDonald sent a declaration to Congress about his time in Japan. Despite his detention, he spoke highly of his stay and said he had a lot of respect for the Japanese people. After that, he lived a relatively quiet life and fell into obscurity. His story becomes more or less forgotten in the history books.
He was really an example to me of a true transnational person. He doesn't fit into normal categories.
In other words, McDonald was a true globalist. He didn't really represent one country or one story. And according to Schott, the history books don't really know what to do with these types of figures.
Most histories are national histories. Most histories that we're aware of are written in a national context. And that's one reason that he has been forgotten in many respects. And it's also one reason that he needs to be remembered.
There is one group leading that charge. Every summer since the late 1980s, members of the Friends of McDonald Society have met in Oregon to celebrate McDonald's life. They also visit his gravesite in Washington State. Eiji Nishiya, the historian, is part of this group. Every year, he picks up a small stone from the spot in Rishiri where McDonald landed and brings it to his grave in Washington. He tells me to pick one up, too. McDonald spent only 9 months in Japan in total, but there's a reference to his stay on his tombstone. Here's what it says. Ronald McDonald, 1824 to 1894, son of Princess Raven and Archibald McDonald. His was a life of adventure, sailing the seven seas, wandering in far countries, but returning at last to rest in his homeland, sayonara. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman, Rishiri Island, Japan.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego, online at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Mary Elizabeth Alexander, Sarah and Stephen Bass, Stephanie Fox and Drew Britcher, Deet and Paul Meserve, and Corey Zanin. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. From PRX.